erotic love is at the centre of Dante's journey through the Divine Comedy, and indeed was the central defining energy or force that he reckoned with throughout his life. It's well known that it awoke early in him when, at about the age of 9, he sees Beatrice, about the same age, on the streets of Florence, and pretty quickly recognises that he's not just seen a beautiful woman who is going to preoccupy his mind pretty much constantly throughout the rest of his life, particularly when she subsequently died quite young, but that he'd also seen something more than just another human being. He'd seen the divine life and beauty that dwells within us all. He calls Beatrice an angel in some of his poetry. And that bringing together of the divine within us and the human that is most explicitly manifest of us is in a way the heart of his journey through love. He realizes that love is felt powerfully, actually as a kind of ignorance. We're mistaken about what we desire, even as this desire floods through us. And so love, erotic love, becomes closely associated with the energy that might bring awakening to what we actually already have, already can know, if only we can find a way through the turbulence that ignorance about that can bring. Now, this is significant not just for its own sake, but within the Christian tradition, particularly because erotic love is not well treated as a rule. It comes up in the mystical traditions a bit, because they draw in particular on Plato, who realised something similar to Dante, that erotic love can lead us, as Diotima, the priestess, explains to Socrates, on a kind of journey that is a discovery of what's good, beautiful and true that always, everywhere, dwells within and around us. And when we make contact with that, the journey of love, as it were, comes to an end. So Christian mystical traditions follow this through. But mainstream Christianity doesn't, really because of a kind of mistake, I think, that particularly the Apostle Paul made when he, early in the Christian period, defines Christian freedom against Roman freedom, and in particular around the issue of love, because it was an important facet of Roman freedom, if you were free, that you could do what you wanted with your body and with other bodies. And for very good reasons, Paul was clearly horrified at this, but I think mistakenly chose to define Christian freedom, which is found in the being of God, against Roman freedom. And so he uses erotic desire, erotic love, to mark where Christianity has gone wrong. He makes sort of allowances, of course, because people must get married, people must have children, and so says kind of marry if you must. But unfortunately, that sets a kind of tenor that certainly in Western Christianity powerfully still shapes attitudes towards erotic love, denying certain types, trying to cajole other types. When the mystical tradition, reaching back to Plato and flowering intermittently, particularly in the work of Dante, realizes that that leads nowhere. Erotic love actually is an energy that can carry us back to the divine, if only we can understand it aright. And so Dante is really important in the Christian tradition as someone who is well known of, half well known about, and so teasing more deeply what his link between erotic love and divine awakening and what that really was about can be nothing short of liberating, in fact, because we all experience erotic love. all find it troubling at times, but need also to know that there is a clue within that very trouble that can lead to the divine. Now, let's turn to Dante's journey then and see how this unpacks throughout the Divine Comedy. The setting for the Divine Comedy, the times, and in particular Dante's experience of meeting Beatrice, was greatly enabled by this tradition of courtly love that was flourishing then. And in particular, it's this understanding of love that enables Dante to realise that when he meets Beatrice, he hasn't just met a beautiful woman who might satisfy all his desire. That, in a way, is what courtly love became when it turned into romantic love, the idea of love that tends to dominate our imaginations now. There's a kind of lost half out there somewhere who, if we meet, will complete us and so enable us to lead happy lives, shapes a thousand love stories now. But courtly love that became before that was significantly different, because there was still, in the medieval period, a felt perception that being wasn't just horizontal. It wasn't just about the world immediately around us, with we human beings trying to find our way through it, but that there were many dimensions to being, to existence, spiritual dimensions, if you like, reaching up through heavens, different qualities and entities around us, like angels. So there was a much richer spiritual ecology. And what courtly love was about was focusing love's desire, love's energy, on these deeper elements, which are also, in a way, more intimate parts of our experience. The transcendent is often the most imminent when it's experienced as filling out our sense of life, as opposed to keeping it rather flat and monodimensional. And so the idea within courtly love was that this passion would be awakened within you, particularly men falling in love with a woman who they would never be able to know, say, in marriage, which was the case for Dante and Beatrice, because about the same time as they met, they were also betrothed to the people that would become their wife and their husband, respectively. So they knew, Dante knew right from the get-go, that he was never going to be able to satisfy his love for Beatrice in a kind of humdrum way. But that enabled him to see this more that Beatrice channeled. Now, sometimes that is described in the literature as the divine feminine, and it's talked about as if the problem Christianity had was losing touch with the divine feminine. And maybe this even reaches back into the Old Testament, when the ancient Hebrews started to worship Yahweh and Yahweh alone, and in particular denied the presence of Asherah and the female goddesses of the Canaanite world. And the idea then is that we need to rediscover the divine feminine to complete things. But I think this is a kind of spiritual version of romantic love, as if there's a lost half for men, a lost female half for a male culture, a lost feminine aspect that, again, is actually modern. It comes with the modern sense that the world is split. It comes with modern notion of dualisms. And in particular, you see this in Jungian psychology, where male and female are talked about as complementary parts that must somehow come together. You know, so the male discovers the anima within, the female discovers the animus within. And when they can bring those aspects of themselves into a kind of completeness, they themselves will be complete. But I don't think that is what happened in the ancient world. The world was not split into complementary halves. Rather, it was experienced as this chain of being, this spiritual ecology that, as it were, reached down from the highest heavens, from God's being itself, and fills the whole of creation. You know, it's why Dante descends into hell, ascends Mount Purgatory, and then rises through the heavens in the paradise. This is the chain of being that his journey is about. And so love in this context is about realizing that as human beings, we have the potential consciously to share in this experience of the chain of being. Our awareness can develop so that, as it were, can reach right across the whole of creation, from the divine to the earthly. We're between the beasts and the angels, as Saint Augustine put it. That, though, is very hard, because when this experience of love first awakens within us, it typically does so when we fall in love with someone else, as Dante did with Beatrice. And so it sets an initial stage of loving, which presumes that love will be satisfied when we find this person, this object, and possess it. Now, Dante confronts this possessive kind of love at the early stages of his journey up Mount Purgatory in his first dream. And on the first night on the mountain, he and Virgil sleep. And Dante has a dream, which is one of possessive love, actually violent, kidnapping love, rape almost, because he dreams that the god Jove, Jupiter, snatches Ganymede, the beautiful youth, and carries him into the high heavens in order that the beautiful youth might stand beside him in his courts on Mount Olympus. Jupiter wanted Ganymede and treated Ganymede as a possession that he could have. And the canto in which Dante describes this is actually full of all sorts of imagery of this possessive love. And Dante's dream alerts him to the fact that this is the kind of love that's dominating his imagination. It's the first step of his awakening. And it's deeply uncomfortable, because to realise that love, which is supposed to be this good thing, actually is this desire to have and to hold, to maybe even violently possess, cling to, perhaps even rape, is deeply uncomfortable as a recognition within yourself. But the flip side is that it is a recognition that this desire is something at work inside you. It's not actually located in the object, in the object of your desire. And so it's the first crucial step to, as it were, bringing love back into yourself, returning it to your inner life as the place where the ignorance that love is all about can begin to be undone. The way that this develops for Dante when he awakens from his dream, full of horror that this is what he's had. I mean, after all, he's on Mount Purgatory. He knows that he's going to be saved. This is the place of hope. It's supposed to be the good part of the journey after the darkness of hell. So to awaken to this realization is not what he wanted. However, Virgil tells him that when he was sleeping, something else entirely different but related was going on, because one of the beautiful women from heaven who is looking after him on his journey, Lucia, had appeared. And she had carried him a little bit further up the mountain. She'd seen that the going was getting tough. And so her love for him lifted him and carried him a little bit further up. So the next question is what this manifestation of the god of love within. Lucia also means light. So there's associations there with beauty and being drawn. What Lucia had carried him to. And it's not an easy resolution of things. In fact, it's where his confrontation with how love has grown within him in this possessiveness begins. Because, first of all, they find themselves now outside the gate that marks the entrance to Purgatory proper. And this gate is marked by three steps. And I think the steps are Dante realizing that he has this love within him, which is quite powerful, quite overwhelming, that he must look at it, and that it's going to be ugly, it's going to be quite a mess, and the steps are coloured in three stages that I think represent, as it were, this realisation for Dante. But if he can cross the threshold by climbing the steps, embark on the difficult part of the journey in Mount Purgatory, there's the promise of where it will lead. And sure enough, this begins the journey across the first three terraces of Purgatory. There are seven in total, but across the first three. And in the first one, he meets those who are wrestling with pride. And I think pride here means struggling to realise that the good things within yourself you don't possess, you don't own. They're a manifestation, an echo, a reflection of the goodness that runs through all things. And so letting go of pride is letting go of that claim to possess what you had thought of as your own good things. So similarly, it's about letting go of this sense that our satisfaction is found in objects. The second terrace is the terrace of the envious. And I think this is about a related problem that we all face, which is when we envy the good in others, we long to have what they have, and so become envious of them. And on this terrace, Dante sees the souls with their eyes stitched shut, so that they can only look within themselves and find these good things within themselves. So that's the second terrace. And then the third terrace is the terrace of the wrathful. And I think this is about the passion of love gone wrong. So actually it darkens the world around them. Dante and Virgil find themselves in clouds that are so thick they can't even see their hands in front of their faces. And of course passion can do this when it clouds, it becomes a storm cloud and so obscures the way, rather than love being a guide along the way, the light that was the light of Lucia. And so Dante confronts these aspects within himself, even as he navigates his way up these terraces, but manages to realise that wanting the good as if you own it, pride, can be let go of. Seeing the good in others, and so failing to see it within yourself, can be let go of envy. And this love, this passion within us can get out of control, and so become a kind of rage rather than the energy that carries us further back to the source of all things, which is the source within us, helps to let go of this ignorance. Dante achieves that across these three terraces. And then he has his second dream. And it's the second night on Mount Purgatory now, and he has his second dream, which is a kind of more subtle version of what he confronted in his first dream. In his second dream, it's not that he tries to grab, as it were, someone and abduct them as Jupiter had Ganymede. Rather, he looks on a siren in his dream, this kind of distorted version of femininity. And with his imagination, he makes the siren desirable. And this is the sense that lust can reach a stage where it can look at almost anything and want it, get sexual satisfaction from it, desire to possess it. And at first, when Dante awakens from this dream again, he's horrified. He thought he was making progress. And in a way, this second dream is even worse. I think nowadays, with my psychotherapy hat on, we would call this perverse love, where erotic satisfaction is sought in all sorts of things, from fetishes to pain, as it were, in its desperation to seek satisfaction and its sense of failing to do so, it will try to find satisfaction sexually in almost anything. And Dante experiences that in his second dream. But with the horror of realizing this more subtle side of love and lust comes the second phase of the purification of his love, if you like, because as they then climb the next three terraces, leading to terrace number 6 out of 7, they encounter the distortions of this more subtle nature. So for example, they first come across sloth, which in a way is a denial of the energy of life, of the energy of erotic love. They come across avarice, which is just grabbing any old object as if that's going to satisfy this lust for life. And then they come across gluttony, which is the inability to find satisfaction anywhere, and so just consumes more and more and more. And Dante confronts these different qualities in souls he meets, but also within himself, and is able to see through them, see how they are distortions. And so finally comes to the seventh terrace. Now, this is in a way the culmination of all this awakening within him as to the nature of love within himself and how it's been misunderstood. Because it's called the terrace of the lustful, but actually it's the most refined form of lust, because here he meets poets, and they're poets who have spoken truly of love in their words, but haven't quite managed to manifest that in their lives. And so the fire that they're in, this kind of final purgation, is, as it were, like the fire that blends the metals and that purifies the gold. And it's bringing their being in line with what they saw in their poetry. And so it's the final stage that Dante too must undergo, because he was this great poet of love, understood that he'd seen an angel, he'd seen the divine in Beatrice, had wrestled with that all through his life to that point, and yet hadn't quite managed to bring that together with himself fully within. And that's what these lovers on the seventh terrace are doing. They're unifying what they now know about the truth of love with how they actually experience that in their lives. Incidentally, on the seventh terrace, Dante quite explicitly meets individuals who in life had chosen people of the same sex as their love objects, as well as individuals who have chosen people of the opposite sex as their love objects. Homosexual, heterosexual, as we would now call it, doesn't matter in this more richer understanding of love, because what matters is the nature of the love that you're cultivating within you, and which the object of your love will awaken, but you must realise is not the end of your love, is just, as it were, the first initiation of the passion of love that then can carry you back towards the divine. So by now, fully realising that love is not about what you possess, knowing that love is that which is within you as a passion, Dante steps through the fire and becomes fully aware that the love he'd spoken about in his words, the love which he had seen with his mind's eye and reached for, orientated his life around, awoken through his meeting with Beatrice, he now experiences fully in his heart. And so the possessiveness that was the passion now becomes an imperturbable, kind of unshakable awareness within him that he is actually one with himself, with those around him, with the whole of creation. And he's beginning to get the sense that he is even one with the divine, that his being is rooted in the divine being, and that that was what his earlier loves had not seen, had been ignorant of. Now this comes to him, I think, in his third dream. After the fire, they spend the third night on Mount Purgatory. It's a very beautiful, peaceful evening, and they lay down to sleep, and Dante has a dream. And this time it's a dream of peace, because he dreams of seeing two women, Rachel and Leah, and one of them is gathering flowers to make ornaments for herself. And I think that what this is saying is that she understands that her beauty and the beauty of nature around her is one beauty. And then he looks at the other woman, and she is contemplating her inner life. And so what that aspect is the realization of your inner life and the divine inner life being one inner life. And so there's this sense that across the chain of being, from ourselves, from what's on earth, what's through creation in the heavens and into the divine, actually is one, united in this beautiful perception which he experiences in his third dream. Dreams are so significant because they speak to us as to the nature of our inner life, when, as it were, our ego can't control it, can't try and defend us against what we don't want to see. And so this movement across Dante's three dreams is immensely powerful and significant. He now knows that there's a part of him that can experience the divine with this experience of beauty and love that's neither riddled with possessiveness nor with distorted, perverted passion. And that marks the beginning of his journey into paradise. Paradise is, in a way, the extension of this realization throughout the whole of his awareness. You know, it might begin, as it were, as a seed of light, a little nugget of perception, and the task now is to become more and more aligned with that, which is what happens as he ascends through paradise. It again begins quite shockingly, because Dante actually meets Beatrice at the top of Mount Purgatory, and she profoundly chastises him for not having realised this when they first met on the streets of Florence. He chastises her for having looked for alternative objects when she died and not realising that her human beauty was bound to deteriorate in the transient world that's all most immediately around us, that's most manifest around us, and that he should have used this as the opportunity to try and penetrate into the lasting beauties, the lasting joys and loves that she was actually transmitting, and realise the truth about the unity of being. I mean, it can sound quite esoteric, but I think we do get intimations of this in various parts of everyday life. If you've ever seen a child asleep in its mother's arms, completely content, completely relaxed, I think that's intimation of this imperturbable experience that Dante has now tasted. Deep sleep, many wisdom traditions point to deep sleep as another example of this. You know it because you wake up the next morning and think, I feel completely rested. You had, as it were, fallen into the arms of being itself and known it as part of yourself, and that is what brings the peace. Another example that you sometimes see is when you meet an old couple who've been together for years and years. They've almost become one in their being. They're completely at ease with themselves, and it's a lovely thing to see. So these intimations of this spiritual perception of love are actually all around us, if we can allow them to draw us as well. As Dante ascends through the heavens, he meets other lovers. And again, they're quite surprising often, because with a moral understanding, they might be thought to be condemned as lovers. But actually, what Dante realises is that these lovers had virtues that enabled them to see the unity of love right across the cosmos. So, for example, he meets Rahab, who was the prostitute in Jericho. And he realises that although she was a prostitute and condemned morally, virtuously, she had access to a kind of openness that was able to say yes to life, and so say yes to God. And that is what enables her to experience the love that is the unity of all things known in paradise, the paradisal state. He also meets a woman called Kunitsa, and she was a contemporary of his. He meets her when she's an older woman, but throughout her life, she was well known to have been quite a colourful character. She had many husbands, several lovers, and yet what Dante sees in heaven is not that she was therefore condemned for her promiscuity, but that her promiscuity had in its heart been a welcoming of all love that had actually led to this quite colourful life, but also enabled her soul to perceive the truth of love, which leads her to the experience of heaven. Now, the final sort of seal of this realization, as he perceives this love in the characters around him, as it were, starts to realize that what's within himself is also in those that he meets, this nature of being, is when he comes to the heaven of the fixed stars, and particularly he enters the constellation of Gemini, which is his birth sign. And I think this is him realising that the time and place into which he was born shares the love that he knows within himself. He feels welcomed as he steps into Gemini. He always already was welcome in his birth sign, in his time and place, in his very life, which of course is not just his earthly life, but his divine life as well. He meets, in particular, the Apostle John, who is, in the Christian tradition, the figure that personifies, embodies, brings reflection on love in particular. And it's very interesting because he actually goes blind when he sees John. And you might wonder why. He's now in the very high heavens indeed, and yet it seems there's a sort of further refinement which his blindness brings. It's not an alarming blindness, actually, but it came about because of a sort of final tweak of Dante's experience, now knowledge of love. Because when he bumped into John in these highest heavens, he looked at John to see whether a miracle that was said to have occurred to John in the medieval period was actually true. And of course, looking for miracles is to look for objective signs of God, as it were, to perhaps anxiously reach into the world to try and get confirmation of divine presence. And again, that seeking objective clarification, seeking something that you need as if that's going to take you to God, is the fundamental mistake that he's been wrestling with all along. And so when he looks to John to confirm a miracle, he goes blind. He loses, it seems, momentarily, all that he had gained right close to the culmination of his journey. But it's rectified soon. He realizes his mistake. He returns to himself, which means he returns to the being that he shares with all those who are now around him. And he and John celebrate love. They celebrate love right throughout the whole creation. They celebrate the manifestation of love that, seen aright, can be felt and known right across history. And they see love even in the everyday. John says to him, but no, tell me how love bites you day by day. And so Dante celebrates how that is known intimately throughout the whole of life, as well as with this more expansive vision. He also, interestingly, meets Adam, the aboriginal human. And Adam tells him about what you might call the original way in which human beings participated in the life of God. When first created in Eden, we were made to know God without mediation, directly, without hindrance, without the need to possess, because it could be encountered always, everywhere, within us and around us, the state of Eden. And Adam shows Dante that when he meets him in paradise. So again, it kind of just amplifies this sense which he has, that further stage. And now he's ready. He knows that there's no place where love is not. He knows that he doesn't need to possess it. He doesn't need to galv his passion as if love is somehow scarce. He can rejoice in it. And so at the culmination of the Divine Comedy, he famously experiences himself turning perfectly, as if a perfectly balanced wheel, with the love that moves the sun and the other stars. He has awoken to actually what was always true, but his love needed to be clarified in order to know that awareness within himself. The ignorance is lifted. He realizes that there are no objects in divine reality with this awareness, although in a way what he had taken to be objects were the necessary digressions, as Beatrice had called them, that could awaken him to return to this state, which he now knows in a Trinitarian way as his unity with all being, as a conscious awareness of that unity, and as the bliss, which is the peace, satisfaction, and fulfillment, completely imperturbable, undisturbable, and thoroughly known, which is really what love sought, but needed to find it already had all along.